He hadn't any picnic basket, and his hands were pocketed. Then out came one hand, and he waved at us like some old friend. "It's him," I said. Dad sighed. "What's he want? Who is he?" Roxana wondered. Dad didn't answer. Where was he supposed to start? "Jeremiah?" "Well, you'll see."
"Hello," said Martin Andreessen, walking up. "Hello, Jeremiah? Reuben? Say, where's your girl?"
Dad looked round. Swede had disappeared as briskly as that juniper tree.
"Exploring, I guess. You're in time for supper, Mr. Andreessen." "Thank you, I ate."
The putrid Fed picked a boulder and sat himself down. He popped loose a cigarette and lit it from ground fire, then took a big puff and winked at me through the smoke. He always acted like he was your favorite uncle visiting from India. Boy, it was aggravating.
"Roxana, this is Martin Andreessen," Dad said. "Martin, Roxana."
"My pleasure, Mrs. Cawley."
It was quite a moment while Andreessen smoked and looked around. You couldn't help but notice he was kind of a handsome jerk, sitting there in the glow. He looked extremely tickled also. I figured we were in serious trouble on account of staying hid so long.
"Well?" Dad inquired. "I'm pleased," Andreessen replied, "to have run across you again. Do you know, I had some car trouble back in Linton."
"Looks like you're fixed up now."
"I'll be honest, Mr. Land. We are getting close to Davy, and the closer we get, the more dangerous for him. I'm not threatening anyone. It's just the truth."
"Go ahead."
"I'm asking for your help. I understand your reluctance."
"I can't help you. If you're close, as you say, you already know more than I do," Dad replied, adding, after a moment, "just for the sake of discussion, how close do you suppose you are?"
"He's in the Badlands," Andreessen said.
"You appreciate the Badlands are fair-sized." Andreessen smoked a little, appeared to decide on forthrightness.
"A rancher not far from here keeps a few pigs in his barn. Last week, the daughter went out to do chores, and her favorite of these pigs was missing." "Yes, her favorite." "Pen closed, barn door shut." "Well, these mysteries happen sometimes. Pigs are smart, I understand. So they didn't call the sheriff till they lost a second pig the same way. Vanished from a shut pen," Dad said.
"Wait a minute. You think it's Davy taking these animals? That he's here?"
"Not far from here."
"Did somebody see him?"
Andreessen said. "I expect he'd be taking them for food, don't you?"
"Did they see him?"
Andreessen seemed to feel he had offered adequate detail. "Yes, almost certainly."
He leaned over, dropped his cigarette into the fire, then peered down after it.
"What we'd like, Mr. Land, is for you to come with us, just for a day or two, and drive around a little."
"Drive around?" Dad said.
"We'd appreciate it."
Through all this, Roxana had held silent. Of course, I didn't know how much Dad had told her regarding Davy. Nothing in our hearing. Clearly, he hadn't breathed a word about old Putrid here. Yet, watching Roxana, you'd have guessed she not only knew my brother, but had raised him herself and tutored him in evading the law. Her face was shut and latched against Andreessen, which I suppose isn't surprising, given how her great-uncle felt about Pinkertons. "Drive around," Dad mused. "Mr. Andreessen, do you still believe I can somehow lead you to my son?"
"Not by natural means," answered Andreessen.
"Do you suspect other kinds are at my disposal?" Andreessen said.
"The work I'm in sometimes overlaps into other domains. You may be able to help us. I would say, calibrate our search."
Dad stiffened. "I'm no diviner. Don't talk to me about it."
"No offense intended," Andreessen said. "But hear me out. Will you hear me out?"
Dad didn't answer.
2 years ago, there was a kidnapping, a little girl in Michigan. The kidnapper put her in a rented cabin and drove away to find a phone booth. Only he went off an icy curve and smacked a barn, and that was it for him. Want to guess how we found the little girl?
Just finished, Mr. Andreessen. I don't blame you. Actually, I thought my supervisor was off his nut. He'd been talking to the family and their friends. There was a sister, about 11. He came to me. This is Ray Levy, my supervisor. He thought the sister could locate the little girl.
You don't know what you're associating with, Dad said.
Well, that's the truth, and I don't pretend to. But the sister went out with us. We drove in rough circles, starting from their home.
Listen, it's not exactly procedure, and it doesn't make any popular sort of sense.
To his credit, Andreessen appeared less than cozy with this story he was telling. He lit another cigarette and looked at it while he talked.
At some point, she began telling us where to turn. It upset her. She cried and so forth. And we made some wrong turns. I'll not lie to you.
We all knew the ending, though, same as you do.
Well, we found her just before dark, he said. The cabin was freezing. She wouldn't have made it till morning.
The whole thing made my inside sick. Don't get me wrong, I was glad the little girl was all right. Yet it gave me a seasick clutch behind the ribs, as if my heart were bobbing loose. I wanted to bolt from there.
For I found I didn't hate Andreessen anymore. I feared him, not knowing why, and can testify to you that this was worse.
I can't do what you're asking, Mr. Andreessen, Dad said.
You're a man of faith. Everyone says it.
It isn't faith you're speaking of. It's something else. Foolishness or spookism.
There's a man back in roofing who believes you have access to something large, Andreessen said. Some unusual authority, he clarified.
For goodness sake, be quiet, said Dad.
Your boss, Mr. Holgren, the fellow who fired you?
Dad stood up.
I thank you, he said, for keeping us informed.
Should anything develop, we've taken rooms with Mrs. Cawley. You may reach us there. At which Andreessen stood up also, handing Dad a card with a phone number, stressing his sincerity and hoping Dad would reconsider. We watched him walk back down the valley, vanishing amid firelit boulders. Now, no doubt you're asking some of the same questions I asked Swede later, back at Roxana's, such as, why hadn't Andreessen arrested us on the spot? Complicit fugitives that he figured us to be.
I don't know, she answered.
We were getting our pajamas on, the various thrills of the evening still working through our veins. And why, if he was so confident about closing the net on Davy, was our putrid willing to subscribe even to spookism to nail him down?
Don't know, Swede said.
What is spookism, anyhow? I complained.
The word conjured a scary version of faith in which a person believed mostly in malicious unseen fellows who might creep up behind you and breathe on your neck hairs.
But Swede paid no mind. She was wholly taken with the ambrosial thought of staying on at Roxana's and the turns of the past few hours. From no hint of Davy to an eyewitness sighting? From another frozen road trip to a warm reprieve in a home that felt more like the term than roofing ever had. I had to agree with her. It went to show that anyone could deliver good news, including a person like Martin Andreessen, even if he wasn't doing so purposefully, and even if he was the king of pukes in most respects. The throbbing heart of news. I was carrying a hatful of eggs in from the barn and saw a man sitting a horse on the hillside back of Roxana's. This was next morning before full light, and he was perhaps a half mile from the house, so what I saw was the black shape of him up there. The rider was Davy. I knew it without question. He sat the horse and watched me. The horse was still but for its flapping tail, and as the light improved, we looked at one another across the half mile of clean blue snow. I was sure it was Davy. Yet I wouldn't have been made a fool of, so I looked at the house to see who was watching. Nobody was. I waved. The horseman didn't wave back. He turned and started working round the side of the hill. I could see the plunge and the heave of the horse's chest and the Roman curve of its neck as it struggled through the deep snow. The rider urged it forward, following some upward path. Alarmed lest he leave my sight, I peeled for the house, herded the eggs across the countertop where Swede was waiting to candle them, and churned back outside. horse and rider were gone.
"What's going on?"
Swede yelled. She'd followed me and was on the back step in an apron. Roxana had promised to teach us her great-uncle's cinnamon rolls, those he had served to young Butch Cassidy.
"There was a guy on a horse up the hill there," I pointed.
Not one to hold back, I'd certainly have claimed it was Davy, except Roxana appeared in the door to say her neighbor Lonnie Ford pastured cattle on that hill and on others beyond it, and kept a trail open during the winter. She had mentioned this Lonnie before, a rancher who preferred to be horseback than at home with his wife, who, according to Roxana, took little joy in range beeves or the pastoral life in general.
Swede said, "We're going to make the rolls. You coming in?"
"I'll be just a minute." The door shut. I jogged to the barn, as though perhaps I'd forgot something out there, slipped in nonchalantly, then sped through to the back, dislodging hens. I vaulted into the goat pen and banged out the door into the small corral. From here, I could trot off toward the hillside in question without being observed from the house. It wasn't that I wholly believed any more the horseman I'd seen was Davy. You can imagine how my hopes slumped when Roxana mentioned the rancher Lonnie Ford. But it sure had looked like Davy, even if the distance was great and the light poor and the thinking wishful. If nothing else, I meant to get up to where the horse trail was and follow it a little ways. It was something to do that was real and outdoors and required work. As such, it was also a spontaneous adventure. I could picture how Swede would react later.
"You thought it was Davy, and you just took right off after him?"
Why, it was like something Davy himself would do. Feeling lively and prideful, I pressed forward. The sun was full out. The field was a glacier. I lifted my eyes to the hills. What a hike, though. While most of the snow had blown into chalky dunes a boy could walk on, in the lee some of the drifts lay soft pockets that could drop you waist deep, and then it was a tough slog. Such travel eats time, and I imagine ways my spontaneous adventure might turn out, the better to entertain Swede. Suppose I followed the horse trail to the far side of the hill and there encountered Lonnie Ford. What would he say to a boy who'd tracked him so boldly? While Roxana described him as middle-aged, I imagined Mr. Ford as young. He'd look young enough to me that morning, though anyone knows a man looks younger on horseback. It's the effect of the mount on your posture. Even August Schultz shed years when he rode, and placid in nature. I imagined coming on him round the side of the hill, warming his hands over a twig fire, in fact probably brewing some coffee in a pot up there, not being welcome to do so at home, where his wife sat pining for skyscrapers. I imagined him turning to me, pleased for company, though not the sort of fellow who'd say it in so many words, asking my name, walking over to his patient horse, taking a tin cup from a saddlebag.
"Coffee, Reuben?"
"Thank you, Mr. Ford. Yes, that'll do." Here I was, taken suddenly aback by my own poetic deficiency. Were Swede out adventuring, she'd surely concoct spunkier upshots than a cup of joe with a hen-pecked rancher. I started again. I'd come round the side of the great hill, which I was starting to climb now, to my relief, and there he'd be, the aloof and dark-browed and oft-times terrifying Ford, and stretched before him on the snow would be the corpse of the calf he had come seeking, a corpse ripped open, throat to guts, eyes froze wide, tongue pushed out like the hump beef tongues at Otto Schock's Red Owl. And Ford would be kneeling there, fingers touching the perfect blood-borne tracks of a stupendous wolf. A fearful sight. And Ford would turn to me, and,
"Boy," he'd growl, "what are you doing up here? These hills aren't for wandering on foot. Come look at these prints.
As big as my face.
Notice, boy, he didn't even eat. He kills for sport. Probably," Ford would conjecture, squinting about, "probably is watching us even now."
Well, you can see why Swede was the writer, but I did devise several more such overbaked scenes, and they made me happy enough and killed time until I reached the horse trail, which, once reached, was nothing but the track through drifts of a single long-legged horse and not the clean footpath I'd imagined. I slumped to my haunches. Trail, my eye! It was thigh-deep in snow, and all the worse for the fact that a horse had walked on it, breaking through the crust. The truth is, I nearly cried at this point, for I'd worked so hard to get here, and Mr. Ford had no doubt ridden home by now anyway, and Sweet, of all unfairnesses, was back in Roxana's kitchen stirring up cinnamon rolls. I stewed in this distress till my hind end, which had rocked back in the snow, started with that cold ache that's worse for also being soaked. Then, getting up, I looked back at the house and barn. Well, they were way back there. A very decent stretch, considering the terrain, and considering I was a pauper in the lung department. It stirred me up. I clawed snow off the back of my pants. In fact, though I badly wanted to go home and warm up, I now saw that at this height the hill tapered considerably, and that the snow up here looked generally hard swept. It also occurred to me that cinnamon rolls are made with yeast and take a good while to rise. What would it hurt to follow the horse trail as planned? Might not Mr. Ford even now be round that bend, examining the slaughtered calf? I trotted ahead, keeping the trail on my right. From someplace a cow bawled, and the sound rattled around the frozen hills. Practically before realizing it, I'd come round and was looking down at a valley beyond which rose more and steeper hills, some with barren, stratified cliffsides, others with juniper and twisted scrub pine dabbing up from the snow. 20 yards down the trail sat Davy on a stamping bay horse. He looked smaller and darker than my memory of him. I didn't say anything. He looked me over while the horse ducked and steamed and shook its head. He had on a fur cap with ragged long flaps that fell to his chin and a green army parka so large the sleeves were rolled back. Over his jaw lay a whiskery scrub that erased the boy I might have expected. When I looked at his face, I felt dizzy and fearful, for it was Davy's face, and yet another's also. But my faintness disappeared when he grinned under the hat and chuckled, and nodded the horse forward, saying, "Pretty long climb, wasn't it, Natty Bumpo?" It was hard to talk at first. He walked the horse up and offered me his hand. I took it, and he lifted me up behind him. I sat back of the saddle on the horse's wide rump, a slippery arrangement. I kept tilting one way or the other while we worked down the back side of the hill. It was steeper here, and the horse, name of Fry, kept skidding sideways and catching himself. I leaned forward and grabbed Davy around the ribs. "It's all right, Rube. He's good at this." But to me it was like standing on a steep roof in wind, and I hung on tight. It was such a relief to hold on to my brother again, but it was strange also. Davy's coat smelled smoky, sulfurish. He was thinner and harder than I remembered. He seemed compressed. He spoke to the horse in quiet, clipped phrases. We bumped and slid and finally angled down to a stand of juniper, where the hill leveled out, and there Fry stopped. "You all right?" Davy asked. "Sure thing," I said. "Nice horse," I added, as if I could discern any such thing. "You freezing?" "I'm okay." "Jump off, why don't you?" "Okay." But I monkeyed around quite a bit. The trouble came when I lay bellywise across the horse with both legs hanging down. Then I froze, for once starting the downhill slide, there'd be no stopping, and Fry seemed a tall animal. "You're clear, Rube. Slide away," Davy encouraged. "Yup," but I hung tight. I couldn't see my feet. That was the difficulty. Then Fry lost patience and hunched right, and I slipped down, missed the earth, and lit on my back under Fry. The horse stamped, throwing snow in my eyes. I scrambled to safety as Davy swung down, and then he did grab hold of me like I was his little brother for real. And I hugged him back, clenching all muscles so he'd notice how strong I'd become. The best thing was to hear him laugh, and his laugh was, as I remembered, only deeper. Davy always had a lot of bass for his size. "Tell the truth now," he said. "Did you know it was me? How'd you know?" "Well, I could just tell. I knew right away, even far away." I fairly spouted. Back on the ground, I was a geyser of joy and vindication. "I saw you up here and knew it was you," I added. It had been my first thought, after all. He didn't have to know about Lonnie Ford. "You didn't tell anybody, did you?" "Why, no." Not that I meant to portray myself as a boy of wisdom and self-restraint, but it felt fine to have Davy admire me, especially after my clumsy landing.
Good for you, Rube. Man, I'm glad to see you.
The great question suddenly occurred, but how'd you know where we were?
I heard you last night. You and Swede fooling around by that coal vein?
He perched back on a deadfall pine. Swede doesn't sound like anybody else, you know.
I tied Fry and prowled up.
You were watching us? He smiled big.
But you didn't come out. You should have.
Good thing I didn't, wouldn't you say? Davy asked, striking me silent a moment, till I recalled how Martin Andreessen had showed up. He said,
Rube, who was that guy?
So I described the putrid Fed. Though Davy had assumed being the object of pursuit, these were the first particulars he'd heard, and they fascinated him. He wanted a complete portrayal of Andreessen. He wanted to know how he spoke, what sort of things he said, how he treated Swede and me, how he got along with Dad. He got a kick out of Andreessen spying on the Airstream in Linton, the way he waved at us, how he saluted driving away. To my great annoyance, Andreessen didn't come off as badly in the recounting as I felt he deserved. But Davy didn't mind. He kept nodding and smiling and cracking his knuckles. Which reminds me to mention, he was still wearing those yellow farm chore gloves he'd had on the previous fall, the day I shot the goose.
Where do you live?
I asked abruptly. A person can't live outside in the winter with only farm gloves.
Come on, Rube, you were saying how you shook him off in Linton.
True enough, I'd just been getting to the good part, and when I told about Swede slinking over and emptying Aunt Jemima down Andreessen's tank, Davy laughed so hard he tipped over onto the snow, and the horse, Fry, laid back his ears and crutched about stiff-legged. I said,
Are you staying around here?
He quit laughing and looked me over. Not far away. I'd like to show you where, but I better not.
Hey, it's all right.
I wasn't getting teary, but it surely wasn't all right. He said,
It's better if you don't know, Rube.
Which sounded, I thought harshly, like he didn't trust me.
I'm no rat fink, I told him, with some warmth.
Course not, he agreed. We sat on the dead pine while Fry pawed the snow for browse. It might surprise you, after my longing for details, that I got few from Davy. Always one to withhold the personal, he seemed more than usually constrained, as though we were observed or waiting for some third person to join us. He took off his fur hat and hung it from a branch to sway like an islander's removed head. For some reason, I recalled old Mr. Finch, freezing in the wind outside the post office. I felt awful about Mr. Finch and wanted to believe Davy might have too, but I couldn't bring it up without seeming soft, maybe even disloyal. So we talked small a while, which was satisfactory in its way, since we were at least sitting together as in more thoughtless times.
Say, Davy wondered, what is it with Dad and that lady?
So I told how we'd met Roxana, a little about her goats and her dad's theater, and her great uncle who'd consorted with famous robbers. But I didn't do her justice. For example, I didn't tell how ruinous it had seemed only last night, when we'd been on the brink of departure.
Is she liking Dad a lot? Davy asked.
I don't know. You saw them, I said cautiously. What did you think?
She likes him.
Boy, he looks skinny, though. He had pneumonia. He's okay.
How about you? How are the lungs?
When I thought about it, they were on the poor side. Why don't you come down to Roxana's? I'll go down first and make sure Andreessen's not there or anything. Swede'll go crazy. Davy smiled at his feet.
I guess not, Rube.
She's making cinnamon rolls, I said, in the tone you employ trapping toddlers.
Listen, I really want to. You don't know how much. I wouldn't mind meeting Dad's lady friend either. But it sounds like this putrid Fed isn't such a dope.
He's kind of a dope, I said loyally.
Well, he thinks I'm here, and sure enough I am.
How do you figure that?
It seemed to me like Davy ought to have known. What he said was somebody saw you. He said you took a pig out of somebody's barn. A couple of pigs.
Oh, Davy said. Oh. Like a gentleman, he never suggested that Andreessen had simply followed us out here. that had we not set out from roofing, he'd have had no call to suspect the Badlands. Word of two stolen pigs might have reached the local sheriff, but hardly farther. We sat a minute, and he said, "I can't come down, that's all. The truth is, Rube, I'm trying real hard to miss the penitentiary." I couldn't blame him. I still don't. But it put me in a hard spot. "What am I supposed to say, then, when I get back?" "Nothing." He looked at me so alarmed, I recognized my idiocy. "Don't tell Dad, and especially don't tell Swede. Goodness sakes, Reuben." "Okay." But I couldn't imagine going back and not telling Swede, at least. I wasn't even sure it was possible. "Rube," Davy said, "honestly, I can't talk to Dad right now."
"How come?"
Fry was champing about something, and Davy stood to soothe him. At this moment, a clutch of crows that had gathered overhead all decided to move on, and did so, tutting and cawing. My guts went eerie. In movies, this is where you'd look around for the creeping posse. Davy said, "You know what? I didn't steal Fry." It seemed an odd jump. I wouldn't have cared if he had. "He belongs to a friend of mine, a fella who's helped me out." This sounded like good news, somebody on our side.
"A rancher? Is it Lonnie Ford?"
"Nope, no rancher." He wished to laugh here, I could see, but was held to a smile. "This man's in some trouble. Real trouble, Reuben. He's been all right to me, though." Davy stroked the nervous Fry, who continued to blow and push at his shoulder. The horse's fretfulness was transmissive, and my brother seemed to go up on edge. He quit talking to peek here and there. He listened, not as if you might listen for the bloodhound, I now suspect, but as for a distant summons. As we'd listened sometimes, roaming in the timber, expecting to be whistled down for supper. I knew our visit was about over, and in a panic, yanked open every drawer in my brain for a way to prolong it. Davy said, "It's a long walk back for you. Here, I'll take you part way." He was in the saddle before I could reply, seizing my hand, hoisting me up. Fry moved out of the trees without urging and headed back up the hill. I said, "What's your friend's name?" "Nothing right away. Then, Walter."
"Walter what?"
"No, Walter. The last name's Walter. First name is Jape. Jape Walter."
"Jape?
Funny name." He didn't reply. The horse angled up the hill, his front heaving and rearing, so I had to grip Davy even tighter than previously. The whole valley was sunstruck. The day had only grown lovelier, yet I could feel brightness leeching away from me. Doubt crouched in the snow all around. A horrid picture arose, in obscure colors, of Davy lying dead in a dark place, never to be discovered. It shot through me that I would not see him again, that the horse, with every upward plunge, bore us nearer a ruthless parting I was bound to keep secret. My breathing turned thick, a feather pillow ruptured inside. Dad came to mind, and miracles, and I shut my eyes and prayed that when we came round the hillside, he would, by divine leading, be standing there, waiting for us, his face primed with wisdom and responsibility. I believed in this picture as hard as possible, given the short time and Fry's jerky gait. Oh, if it could happen in this way, I'd run home atop the softest snow, so quick would be my feet, I'd shout the whole way there, so regenerate my lungs. We reached the place where Davy'd pick me up, and went farther round until Roxana's place came into view. Davy said, "Whoa, Fry. Rube, you better walk the rest." But I didn't let loose of him. How could I, burdened as I was?
"Rube,
I have to tell somebody about you," I said. Boy, it sounded like whining. He pried my arms away and turned in the saddle.
"You can't do it, Reuben. Not yet. You understand?"
But I wouldn't nod, wouldn't acknowledge this injunction. In fact, I wouldn't look him in the eyes. I never defied Davy before, and it shamed me doing so now. It violated the larger order. In panic, I recognized that without prompt staving, I would weep.
"Then show me where you live," I said.
"Rube, I told you, it's better you don't know." Under my knees, Fry shifted, and I had to grab the cantle to stay aboard. I said, "Show me or I'll tell Dad." So I was a rat fink, after all. No doubt this was a fink-like threat. Yet who was I to bear sole knowledge of my brother's whereabouts? Did I ever claim to be Mr. Atlas, or anybody close? I hung to the cantle and watched Davy consider what I'd said, all the while with the miserable sensation of having wrecked something, but then he nodded. "All right, Rube. Okay. Okay." So stunned was I to have prevailed in this that I let go my grip and Fry took a step and I tumbled right down in the snow.
"We have to get you some practice," Davy muttered as I whacked myself clean.
"Help me up," I said. Already I was picturing Davy and this waltzer living in some kind of wigwam or teepee, smoke coming out of the top. I couldn't wait to see.
"Not now."
"But you said..."
"Tonight." He leaned toward me. "I'm not taking you down there cold. I have to tell Jape you're coming."
Something in the timbre of his voice convinced me this was the proper thing. He said, "Can you get out of the house without rousting everybody?" Well, of course I could. I'd read as much Twain as the next boy. Davy studied Roxana's place.
"Come out back of the barn. Walk straight this way. At least a couple of 100 yards. I'll be close."
He turned Fry, who frisked the first few steps as though glad to be rid of me.
"Wait! What time? When should I come out?"
"When you can," he called without looking back. "I'll be there. I got no other plans."
Something was missing when I got back to Roxana's. Coming in the back, I hung my coat, unbuckled my overshoes, and tossed them in the corner to Gape.
"Hello?"
I yelled. The house was quiet. Was there ever a place you loved to go, your grandma's house, where you were a favorite child, and you arrived there once as she lay in sickness? Remember how the light seemed wrong, the adults off-key, and the ambient and persistent joy you'd grown to expect in that place was gone, slipped off as the ghost slips the body? Yet the feeling eased as I entered the kitchen, for the cinnamon rolls had just come out, with their beguiling aroma, and Swede was busy whisking up frosting.
"Well, where'd you go?" she asked.
"Just a walk. Sorry I missed breakfast."
"You could have told somebody."
"Boy, Swede!" I really was sorry. My dread returned. Hungry as I was, the rolls didn't appeal.
"I looked in the barn and all over."
"I just hiked around a little." Never was I more determined to keep a secret. Should it slip, tonight was sure to fail. She said,
"Were you looking for Dad?"
"No. Isn't he here?"
"Of course not," Swede reported. "He went out driving with Mr. Andreessen."
The last thing you expected, right?
Me too.
"Well, it's true. He got up before daylight and left."
She tested the frosting, picked the coffee pot off the stove, poured a splash in the bowl, and began to flail. I sat down. The truth is, my lungs felt congealed. I was so tired my hands seemed disconnected. Propped on my knees way down there, I said,
"Where's Roxana?"
"She's got a customer."
"How come he went?"
Swede punished the frosting. No doubt she'd have been happier had an answer been available.
"How come he wants to help that guy? He wants them to catch Davy now?"
Of course I was hoping for some refutation here. For Swede to defend Dad's strange decision to accompany the putrid Fed. That was my careful verb, accompany, as opposed to join, assist, side with. Then I thought of something else. What about the spookism? This actually shook me up the worst.
He said it was spookism. He wouldn't go along with that, Swede.
She still didn't reply. Out front we heard Roxana enter the house with her customer. Some happy gas bag slapping money on the counter. We heard the slide of the cash drawer, a goat bleat, the bell ding above the door, then Roxana swept into the kitchen, her eyes bright from wind.
"Reuben," she exclaimed, "where'd you go?"
And she came and kissed my cheek, first time she ever did so.
"Exploring."
"That's good. Find anything?" She was off, hanging up her coat. Swede was preparing to frost the rolls, having beaten the stuff to paste. At this moment, I wanted enormously to tell them about Davy. That would change the color around here. Knowing I couldn't made me sore. I yelled out, "Roxanna, how come Dad went?" She came out of the mudroom and took the chair next to me. I remember she was wearing a deep green sweater with a high cowl neck, and I remember how she put her elbows on her knees to look in my eyes. "He felt he had to go, Reuben. He didn't want you to be angry about it." "But how come?" She measured me for a beat or two. "He was led to go." Led? This was supposed to mean the Lord was in charge and paving your way, such as letting you get fired so you'll be free to leave town, or sending you an airstream so you can go in comfort. Dad knew something about being led, I realized, yet this I could not buy. Led by who? That barf, Mr. Andreessen? Roxanna turned briskly aside, as if deflecting my vulgarity. For a moment, she seemed unable to look at me. When she did, her eyes were so merry, I was stumped indeed. She said, "I don't think Mr. Andreessen could influence your father to clear his throat." "But he went with him." "Reuben, he stayed up all night. I woke and heard him. Do you know what he was doing?" "I suppose praying," I answered miserably. "Yes, not like I ever heard anybody pray." Roxanna stopped there, still not knowing what to say about it. I noted her deep and elegant blush accompanying her search for words. "I got up," she added, "and we talked a while. Swede, don't you think that frosting's a little thick?" It sure was, stuck to the spoon in a fist-sized gob. Roxanna showed her to thin it with coffee and a little warm butter. How we hate waiting for things to make sense, for I can tell you now what Roxanna held back at the time, how she woke to the sound of Dad's voice raised to the pitch of argument, how she thought at first that Andreessen himself had come in that night and the two of them were having it out. Creeping from her room, she heard Dad articulating grievances against the putrid Fed. She discerned adjectives, arrogant and foolish, among others. Yet there was no reply. She listened to Dad, pacing in his agitation. Sometimes he spoke. At intervals, Roxanna heard him savagely racing through King James, as if to back up some contention. "He doesn't know you and doesn't want to," Dad said, gasping then, as though taking a blow. At this, Roxanna covered her mouth, for it occurred to her with whom he wrestled. Having long ago accepted the fact of God, Roxanna had not conceived of going toe to toe with him over any particular concern. "Make me willing if you can," Dad cried, a challenge it still shakes me to think of. What Roxanna heard next was a tumble like a man thrown. She'd have rushed in then, but her muscles went weak, and she sat down in the hall at her bedroom door. She remembers yet the strange warmth that comforted her there. In fact, she fell asleep with her back against the wall, even as chairs tipped and Dad strove in the other room. Waking some time later, she rose without stiffness and found him at the kitchen table. He was at peace, his Bible closed, though his underwear shirt was torn across the chest. He smiled at her. He asked for coffee. When he stood, he held to the back of a chair. But Roxanna didn't tell us all this at the time. All she said was, Dad was praying in the night in great distress over the Andreessen problem, and she got up to keep him company, and their talk ranged far and wide. "He told me how you took down that corn crib," Roxanna said. "He's pleased how strong you're getting." I figured she was trying to win my pardon for Dad. That wasn't so hard. "And then buying groceries with the money?" she added. "I wanted a canoe." "He really did," Swede affirmed. "Well, maybe you'd reach down 3 plates, said Roxanna, "and get out the milk." As I did, she said, "Buying those groceries instead of a canoe? It broke your heart, I bet." "At first," I admitted. "Would you say," she wondered, "that you were led to do that?" I saw what she was getting at, but it only needled me, as the honest point so often does. "Well, sure, led by Swede," I groused.
That's her job, isn't it?
Which drew Roxana's low, beautiful laugh.
Come on, Reuben, she said. Come tell me if these rolls are as good as Mr. Cassidy thought they were.
He actually didn't die in Bolivia, like everyone believed, Butch Cassidy. He died, Roxana claimed, near the windblown hamlet of Reese, Kansas, in 1936. She knew because the outlaw had reappeared in her great-uncle's doorway in Casper around the beginning of the First World War. Howard Cawley had received an officer's commission, his skills as both gunsmith and doctor making him alluring to the U.S. Army. He was packed and sitting at the kitchen table rolling cigarettes when Cassidy banged on the door. Though sporting a limp and cane, he retained the vitality that had so won Howard over. Nope, he hadn't been shot in the famed cantina. He got the limp when an embittered horse rubbed him off on a cottonwood tree. The poor fellows in the cantina? Friends of his. God rest their souls. Two boys, Mark and Pugger, who'd ridden down from California to be vaqueros. It had been advantageous to a Bolivian lieutenant named Jarave to believe and report he had killed the notorious American bad men, when in fact the dead were mere apprentices. Butch and Harry Longabaugh weren't even in Bolivia at the time. They were riding south through Argentina to meet with an American genius, expatriate like themselves, who claimed to have constructed a balloon in which a man could circle the world. Longabaugh had some idea of investing in the genius's proposed expedition. To what likely profit, Butch never divined. Butch only went along, thinking he might get a balloon ride. Swede, during this, had been perched edgewise, waiting to jump in.
I knew he didn't get shot in Bolivia. It was a lie the whole time.
Yes, you can imagine how it pleased Uncle Howard. He felt bad about not offering Butch better hospitality, but he'd got his commission.
And the train was imminent, said Swede.
Yes, there was no question of his not going, Roxana said, though she added how her great-uncle, when old and stove up, confided that he'd come about one whisker from chucking the U.S. Army and going off with Cassidy, and likely would have done it had Butch just said the word.
He should have, said Swede.
And that was the last time Howard saw his friend. Cassidy confided he was taking a new name, Jonas Work, because he liked the honest sound of it. He told Howard to look him up when the war ended, possibly in Kansas, where he planned to enter the windmill business. Cassidy's eyes were lit. He loved windmills, loved to watch them spin. Howard believed him earnest but incapable of commencing the honest life. He said, "Good luck, Butch." "Jonas," Butch replied. Well, wouldn't you agree, exclusivity is the throbbing heart of news? Who else in the world knew the real ending of that story? Who knew of poor Mark and Pugger, of ambitious Jarave? We swelled up large with privileged facts. Think of standing alone on the beach when the shipwrecked survivor slogs ashore with his great tale. Think of uncovering among your papers proof you are the clandestine, long-sought heir of something.
But he died in 36? Sweet inquired.
Roxana rose, smiling, went to a glass-front barrister, and brought out a scrapbook. It had burgundy covers and black pages bound with a ribbon, and it creaked when she laid it open.
This came to Uncle Howard in the mail. The sender remained nameless.
Jonas R. Work. In Reese, Kansas, on the ninth day of October, 1936, at 7 o'clock in the morning, died Jonas Robert Work, esteemed by his community and honored by his country. Mr. Work was 53 years of age. Providence had bestowed on him a firm constitution and strong powers of mind. He was a veteran of the Great War and a member of the celebrated Flying Corps in Lyon. After some dozens of missions, his craft was struck by rifle fire. Mr. Work landed safely, but was captured and held in a Prussian stockade, bearing in his left thigh a bullet which would forever impair his stride. After some months, he escaped at great peril to his life and returned alone to friendly soil. Mr. Work arrived in Reese in spring of 1918, having received an honorable discharge and decorations appropriate to his heroism. He entered straightway on a career in business with the Air Motor Windmill Company, for whom he was a sales representative. it may be confidently said that the majority of windmills standing in Reese, as well as many in the surrounding Flint Hills, were sold and installed by Mr. Work. He was known as expert in locating water, and in this capacity was internationally sought. Thus, he traveled from Kansas to various parts of the world, returning always with a fund of adventurous tales to instruct and amuse the flock of youngsters who were welcome visitors at his veranda. On the morning of his death, he was completing repairs to a windmill at the Howell Watts Ranch. Though Mr. Work climbed to the mill with his usual geniality, Mrs. Watts in her kitchen perceived a shout, peered from the window, and beheld Mr. Work lying at the foot of the tower. She reported that though his pulse stopped within 10 minutes of the fall, the muscular powers of his limbs remained in force for 8 to 10 hours afterward. Such was the power of his constitution. A member of Grace Baptist Church in Reese, Mr. Work died in the hope and faith of his Redeemer. We supposed over that obituary for most of the day, Swede and I, mostly Swede, whose vaulting imagination revealed mine as miserly and torpid. When I supposed it was Longabaugh himself who mailed the clipping to Uncle Howard, she said no, it was probably Longabaugh's valiant sweetheart Etta, who'd caught leprosy in Bolivia and spent her remaining years alone in a shadowy house writing sensational novels undiscovered to this day. When I credited Butch's water-witching acclaim to using a forked stick cut from a hanging tree, Swede pointed out such sticks only worked that were cut from a tree on which an innocent man had hung. All of which was beside the point anyway, since Butch's yearly trips abroad were no water-locating expeditions, but merry reunions with Harry Longabaugh, the two of them playing mischief with European railroads and financial institutions and bathrobe polygamous sheiks. One more? When I suppose Butch's glee at inventing a glorious military reason for his gimpy leg, Swede reversed herself and suggested it was no invention whatever. That he really had joined the army, gimp and all, piloted a frail Jenny over the German lines, and been shot down and imprisoned and escaped. He always did want to fly, she said. Remember the expatriate balloonist? What about his limbs? I asked. The part about his limbs still being strong after he died was creepy. Well, it's not like he got up and was walking around, Swede said. He could have. Chickens do sometimes. Please, Reuben, she replied, exasperated at this disrespectful likening. People would have fainted. She considered the matter. I suppose he just did a few sit-ups out there by the windmill. Butch probably did sit-ups every day. He was a little vain about his physique. When I thought about it, a dead fellow doing sit-ups in your yard might make you faint just as handily as one strolling. I imagined Mrs. Watts running out to help poor Jonas Work, feeling in vain for his pulse. Probably she was weeping at his side when he started sitting up. Probably she thought he was all right, at first anyway. How many sit-ups do you suppose he did? I wondered. Well, it says his muscles were in force for 8 to 10 hours. In that case, he was probably still at it when Mr. Watts came in off the pasture. I imagine him coming through the front door all tired out.
Honey, he'd have said, what do you suppose Jonas is doing out there?
8 to 10 hours. Boy, that was an awful lot of sit-ups. The Little Man's Country. Just past midnight, that hunch bundled behind the barn was me, Reuben Land, in deep regret. Skittish, that's what I was, and unnerved about walking out into the dark. Here all day, I'd imagine the glory of this act, waiting for a certain heaviness in the house, slipping on pants, ghosting down to the kitchen, pocketing ginger snaps, easing shut the door, crossing some hundreds of yards into Davy's night. Just thinking of it beforehand slid me into the company of heroes. Sure, I foresaw some nerves. Dark is dark. But I remembered Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry, afraid that night in the graveyard, and David Balfour ascending the crumbly tower with his uncle downstairs, listening for him to drop. And what about Odysseus, rowing down to hell with a canteen of blood to slake the shade of Tiresias? Odysseus was scared, and look at all he'd been through. Wouldn't I, too, defeat jitters and win out for Davy's sake? Yet I crouched against the barn. It was a moonless night, and you could get little light from stars, even the old familiars of which I now took stock. Big Orion with his belt and slung sword, the hound Sirius at his heel, the Dipper and its strayed member Arcturus. All were as bright as I'd ever seen, yet the world stood back in the void. In fact, say, no doubt it was too dark for Davy, too. How would he find his way horseback among the hills? I cupped an ear. No stamp or wicker. Relieved, I took a few steps from the barn. Even were he not waiting, I had to go some token distance to claim the attempt. I counted steps. 15, 20. You mustn't think I didn't want to see Davy. I was only weak and afraid. At 50 steps, I stopped. The barn was a starless hump in the night. I said, "Davy, you here?" Nostrils jetted at a distance, loosening my guts. Then a tiny shine bobbed and went out and appeared again and arced into a horse's liquid eyeball, and Fry walked up heaving through the deep snow. He pushed his nose at my chest so hard I'd have sat down if not for grabbing his bridle. I smelled the steam from his skin, the sulfur of Davy's clothes. How dumb I'd been to doubt his coming. Then Davy laid hold and yanked me up behind him, not saying a thing, patting Fry to encourage his silence, and he reined the horse about, and we walked up into the hills. As earlier, we didn't talk right away. It was too dark and the going too lumpy. I leaned forward against my brother's back, my arms about his waist. I could feel Fry angling upslope, and my own rear slipping rumpward, a cumbrous type of riding, demanding on my part a chronic forward scoot, taxing muscles novel to me. In this way we continued so long I began to wonder at our direction. It had seemed at first we were following the path I'd broke earlier. Now it seemed otherwise. We kept rising. I craned at the stars, thinking to take a bearing, but the duck and plunge of Fry whisked them up, and I marked only a blue disk at low declivity. Were it Venus or Jupiter, it would mean we were moving west. It was poor information, but something to think about besides slipping off the horse. Davy still seemed unwilling to speak. I could feel his attention directed frontward, a material frontward straining, as though he and not Fry were carrying us, and the work consumed all he could give it. Cresting a long hill, we stopped a moment, while Fry blew and stooped and clipped the snow as though for browse. I let go of Davy to sit straight. I can't describe what we saw. Here was the whole dizzying sky bowled up over us. We were inside the sky. It didn't make the stars any closer, only clearer. They burned yellow and white, and some of them changed to blue or a cold green or orange. Swede should have been there. She'd have had words. She'd have known that orange to be volcanic, or forge-struck, or a pinprick between our blackened world and one the color of sunsets. I thought of God making it all, picking up handfuls of whatever material, iron and other stuff, rolling it in his fingers like nubby wheat. The picture I had was of God taking these rough pellets by the handful and casting them gently, like a man planting. Look at the Milky Way. It has that pattern, doesn't it, of having been cast there by the back and forward sweep of his arm. "Up, Fry," Davy said. "Let's go." "Rube, it's pretty, isn't it?" I was pleased. It was okay to talk. "Do you picture God tossing them out there like that, or setting them up one by one?" We were heading downslope, a more comfortable job. "Are you waxing poetic on me now?" Davy said. "No, I don't think so." "Well, you're waxing something." I shut back up. Fry was rustling along downhill, just as though he could see. Presently, the sound changed under his hooves, and the air turned cushiony. It took me a few minutes to realize we were among trees. Davy said, "Was it hard, not telling?" "Nope." "Dad didn't ask where you'd gone?"
Nope. Davy hadn't any idea, of course, where Dad had gone. I'd wondered whether to tell him, and now decided to wait. Roxanna might be entirely comfortable with Dad's decision, but I wasn't up to defending it to Davy. You get out of there easy enough?
Yup.
In fact, Dad's absence, plus Swede's absorption in the revealed history of Butch Cassidy, had made my exit a piece of cake. Swede, after supper, had gone to her room and shut the door. Seeming so pleased, I knew this was no fearsome pout. Just before bedtime, I called through the keyhole. I heard her bound off the bed, tearing paper. Then a few sheets from her tablet slid under the door. The latest sunny sundown. She had it going, as you will see. I smooched some ginger snaps, I told Davy.
Yeah?
He was interested, probably hadn't had a cookie in months. He reached a hand behind his back, and I set 5 ginger snaps in his palm. Mouth full, he said.
Got some left for you?
Yup. We rode through a treed valley where the snow seemed less, and Fry eased into a smoother walk. I expected momentarily to get where we were going, to see some sign of Davy's life, the glow of a fire through canvas, say.
Is it a teepee? I asked.
What?
You and Jape, do you live in a teepee?
At that, he pulled Fry to a stop. He turned in the saddle.
Rube, there's one thing. Listen to me now. Call him Mr. Waltzer.
Well, sure. I was taken aback. I wasn't about to be too familiar with some grown man I'd never met. What did Davy think I'd turned into since he left?
It's a weighty thing to him, how he's addressed.
You know something? I'd never before heard Davy speak about someone else as though that person and not himself were in charge. Even at home, even with Dad, he seemed to obey pretty much because he wished to.
I'll say Mister.
Good. That's good.
What do you call him?
Davy turned forward.
Jape.
Fry resumed trudging under the stars.
And the girl is Sarah, he added.
The rest was a silent ride. Wary travel induced a kind of vacuum. Surely we climbed and descended many times, yet for me it was all a glide. My impression was of being pulled along, attracted, called. We came up finally into a saddle between 2 hills, looking down at the same sort of fiery valley where Roxanna had taken us to picnic. A great deal less impressive, however. There was one main fissure, wide as an automobile, but glowing only in occasional patches, with the cool radiance of a candlelit pumpkin. Flames showed from a few spotty cracks webbing away, but it wasn't a place to make anyone think of hell or Voltaire. It looked, I would say, beyond its prime, though no doubt someone less inveterate than myself would have been impressed. Davy said,
"Here we are."
I saw the shape of a lighted window set well back from the glowing vane.
"You built a cabin?"
I probably sounded let down.
There's something about a teepee.
He clicked at Fry, who trotted down, wickering, and was answered by at least one horse below. I kept my eye on the window. Then beside it, a door opened, and a man stepped out of it and stood straight and formally in the thrown box of light. We rode to him, and he clasped his hands behind his back and looked at me as though I were money.
"Little brother Reuben," he said, "it is my honor."
"Hi, Mr. Waltzer," I said. He took hold of my arm above the elbow and guided me off the horse. Despite all I was to learn about this man, he knew how to make a boy welcome. That is, he took entire control in a way to make you feel older and soldierly. Hands on my shoulders, he turned me toward himself, amended my posture, tugged at my coat, removed my stocking cap, and tucked it in my sleeve, where it lay without making a line. All this without a word, then he stood opposite me and again clasped his hands behind him. I looked around for Davy, but he was gone with Fry.
Waltzer said, "Look at me, Reuben."
He was of unimposing height, under 6 feet. A practical build, big up top, one of those men you realize why it's called a chest. You had the feeling he had all the tools he needed in there and all in working order and daily use. His hair was dark and tied back in a short bob, and he had a high forehead and 2 rapscallion eyebrows, upswept,
pointed and mobile.
"Hmm," he muttered. Those brows of his scared me. They were like flipped goatees. "Tired from the ride?"
"No, sir."
"Cold?"
"No, sir, just my toes."
"You mean to do right by your brother, I expect."
"Yes, sir," I replied, remembering the Ratfink threat I'd made to get here in the first place. Walzer must know about that. It didn't seem predisposed against me.
"Hungry, are you?"
"I don't need anything, Mr. Walzer. Thank you."
But he wasn't listening. His attention was on something else. He leaned down to me.
"If I were to tell you that those hills you rode over will be shaken to dust, and that waters will rise up in their place, and that creatures like none you can think of will swim in that sea, what would you say to that, Reuben?"
He posited this as though it were imminent, and as though I were alone with him in the knowledge. And so far was it from anything I'd expected, I didn't even know to be careful.
"I guess I'd want to know what day, Mr. Walzer."
He searched my eyes, straightened, and blew out hard through his nostrils like a horse.
"Come in and eat."
The cabin was a clean ruin. I have since seen photos of its ancestors, which were the slave and sharecropper shacks strung beside dirt fields in southern states. It hadn't stud walls, but was built up of chinked vertical boards held by stringers top and bottom, four warped walls laced together to approximate a box. It had a sooty tin roof and a floor of boards over earth, except where some had been removed for a barrel stove. The dirt under the stove was baked black, yet for its poverty the place was livable. The stove flung heat nobly and was topped by a coffee pot and a Dutch oven that smelled of brown sugar. The Dutch oven had a lipped cover holding several fist-sized stones as if to keep in some rebellious meal. There was a tin drum of water with perfection oil, all its name implies painted on it. A corner of the cabin had been enclosed by means of strung ropes from which sheets hung like laundry to the floor. Walzer took a stool at the table under the single window.
"Sit down."
I didn't want to, not without Davy there. I angled against the wall and worked at my overshoes.
"He'll be in forthwith," Walzer said. "A horse isn't a car. Come, sit down."
I hung my coat on a peg and sat. He leaned forward on an elbow, looking at me.
"So you found the errant brother," he said. "Good for you, huh?"
"I guess so."
"Davy doesn't tell me about his family. You're a surprise."
"I'm sorry." His eyes were bright as a badger's.
"Sorry doesn't matter. We should be honest with each other. I have some questions for you, and you've a few for me. Go ahead."
He was so direct I could only doubt his meaning. He wanted me to grill him right now, and then he was going to grill me? He looked at me with pity and impatience. Certainly he'd expected better of Davy's brother.
"Well, what do you want to know?"
"Why you live here," I said. It was the only thing I could think of.